the West's efforts to mobilize the international community behind Ukraine's peace formula are futile and doomed to failure. Also ahead, Niger's coup leaders closed the country's airspace, citing the threat of military intervention from a West African bloc. Welcome to World News. We're live from the Iranian capital, Tehran. Thank you very much for joining us. Our top story this hour, Israel has carried out an aerial attack on Syria, targeting the vicinity of the capital, Damascus. According to the Syrian military, the regime's missiles were launched from the occupied Golan Heights. The military said the country's air defenses intercepted and shot down some of the missiles. The offensive, however, left four Syrian soldiers dead and four others injured. It also caused some material damage. The Israeli regime frequently targets the war-ravaged Arab country, particularly in and around Damascus. The Syrian government has, for a number of times, called on the United Nations to force the Israeli regime to stop its aggression. Damascus says the assaults are in violation of international law and are aimed at propping up terrorists. Meanwhile, there's no end in sight to Israeli violence in the occupied Palestinian territories. An Israeli settler has seriously injured a Palestinian child by running over him in the occupied West Bank. 4-year-old Jabril Sawarka was transferred to hospital following the attack, which took place in a village east of the city of Bethlehem. The settler fled the scene, and the Palestinian kid is now in a critical condition. Palestinians are more exposed to brutality perpetrated by Israeli settlers and forces almost on a daily basis. Also on Sunday, the regime's troops fatally shot three Palestinians in the West Bank. Israeli police claimed the three men from the Jenin refugee camp were planning an attack. The regime has recently stepped up its deadly raids across the occupied territories. More than 200 Palestinians have been killed this year so far. Our correspondent in Ramallah, Mona Kandil, tells us how Palestinian resistance groups have been responding to the Israeli assassinations.
Three Palestinians had been assassinated. One of them is a senior leader of the Jenin Brigades, Naif Abu Swes, as well as two other fighters from the Jenin Brigades as well. The Palestinian resistance groups issued statements vowing to avenge the killing of those three Palestinian fighters. The Jihad movement said that they will not stop the resistance, and that the resistance is the only way to get the Palestinians' rights and to end the Israeli crimes being committed against the Palestinians, saying also that the assassination of three Palestinian fighters will not be silenced, that and that they will avenge the killing of the three Palestinian fighters. We have to mention that since the beginning of this year, 215 Palestinians were killed by the Israeli soldiers and the Israeli settlers. In addition to the three today, this means the number rises to 218, including 40 children and 18 Palestinian females.
Russia says the West's efforts to mobilize the global south to support Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky's peace plans are doomed to failure. The Russian Deputy Foreign Minister Sergei Ryabkov says the West, with its usual sly and deceitful manner, is trying to induce some countries to support Zelensky's position. The Ukrainian president has been pushing his 10-point peace formula, which calls for the full withdrawal of Russian troops from Ukrainian territory. Ryabkov's comments came after two-day talks in the Saudi city of Jeddah aimed at bringing an end to the conflict in Ukraine, but ended without a breakthrough. A senior Ukrainian official, however, called the meeting productive. It had brought together more than 40 countries, including China, India, the US, and several European states. Russia was not invited, but Moscow had earlier described the event a farcical move intended to forge an anti-Russia coalition. Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian has arrived in Japan on an official visit to the country. Amir Abdullahian was warmly received by Japanese officials upon arrival in the capital, Tokyo. Early Monday, the top Iranian diplomat is set to hold talks with his Japanese counterpart and other top officials. Bilateral ties, regional issues, and international developments are high on the agenda. Now, Amir Abdullahian's trip coincides with the anniversary of the devastating U.S. atomic bombings of the Japanese cities of Hiroshima and Nagasaki in 1945. In the meantime, a delegation from the Tehran Peace Museum is in Hiroshima to attend ceremonies commemorating the victims of the atomic bombardment of the city. Tens of thousands of people have gathered in Niger's capital, Niamey, to express support for coup leaders as a deadline by the West African bloc for a military intervention there expires. The crowd gathered in a stadium draped in Russian flags and carried portraits of Niger's junta leaders. They also held French flags with a red cross through it in a sign of an end to the country's decades-long military presence in the African nation. Meanwhile, the junta said it had closed Nigerian airspace as of Sunday until further notice. Junta leaders cited the threat of military intervention from the Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS. The regional bloc had given Niger coup leaders until August 6 to reinstate former President Mohamed Bazoum, but the junta leaders had rejected the deadline.
The crisis in Niger is deepening even further as defense chiefs of West Africa's regional bloc agree on a plan for a possible intervention in the West African nation after the military junta there failed to restore civilian rule following last month's coup. The Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS, has given the junta 1 week to reinstate President Mohamed Bazoum or face the potential use of force. In a statement, after their meeting in Nigerian capital Abuja, ECOWAS said the bloc has taken all necessary measures for a military intervention in Niger.
All the elements that would go into any eventual intervention have been worked out here and being refined, including the timing, including the resources needed, and including how and where and when we are going to deploy such a force. We are determined to stop it.
The bloc said it is seeking democracy in the African country.
Military is not our option of choice. It is the last resort. We want diplomacy to work, and we want this message clearly transmitted to the leaders of the junta in Niger that we are giving them every opportunity to reverse what they have done and to return the country to constitutional order.
The decision to militarily intervene in Niger has been welcomed by France. In a statement, the French foreign ministry said it firmly and resolutely supported efforts by ECOWAS to reinstate former President Bazoum. The ministry added the future of Niger and the stability of the entire region are at stake. An ECOWAS delegation has also arrived in Niger's capital, Niamey, to hold talks with military officials in an effort to reverse the coup and restore the former president. In a separate reaction, Washington also said it supported ECOWAS leadership on Niger.
We strongly support the very strong leadership of ECOWAS on Niger. I don't want to get ahead of where things are, but what ECOWAS has done in terms of stating very clearly that there's an expectation for a return to the constitutional order and a continuation of the democratic process.
The United States has also suspended some of its aid program to the government in the West African nation.
Well, the idea of a military intervention in Niger has created concerns among many people across the country. This is while Western countries are concerned that the West African nation may turn to Russia following decades of French rule there. That's why ECOWAS, backed by France and the United States, is pushing for the toppled pro-West president to be restored to power.
The developments in Niger comes nearly 2 weeks after soldiers belonging to the country's presidential guard blocked access to President Bazoum's residence in Niamey and arrested him. Shortly after the storming of the president's residence, the army led by General Abdelrahman Tiani expressed support for the coup and said its priority was to avoid destabilizing the country. In an instant reaction, ECOWAS urged what it called constitutional order to be restored. The union threatened sanctions if Niger's coup leaders failed to reinstate the ousted president. The sanctions by the ECOWAS were met with angry reactions from opponents of the pro-West former regime.
Closing borders for a country like Niger is not a good thing for a landlocked country, but we're trying to adapt. Like Mali, we're not going to die. I believe that Niger exists and will continue to exist, whatever the decision taken by ECOWAS. What I have to say to ECOWAS is that it must be for the people, not against them. So it's a system that we denounce.
But apart from all the sanctions, what has created concern among many people across Niger has been the idea of a military intervention there. It's stressed that Niger belongs to Nigerians and that they will support the military in face of any intervention.
As Nigerians, we said to ourselves that if the military decided to intervene in the situation, we would be with them all the same, and we're determined to go wherever they want, and we're not even in favor of negotiations. Niger belongs to the Nigerians, so in this sense, we ask only one thing. We ask only one thing. We're asking for the withdrawal of the French from the French military base for them to go home. And we are with our soldiers today because the military are the ones defending us.
The possible military intervention in Niger also drew reaction from Russia. Kremlin spokesperson Dmitry Peskov said it is unlikely that interventions by some non-regional forces can change the situation for the better. As for us, we are monitoring the situation very closely. Of course, we are concerned about the tensions that are now growing in the region. We remain in favor of Niger returning to its constitutional norms as soon as possible without any damage or threat to human life. Putting all the factors together in Niger's recent military coup and the subsequent reactions, what comes to the spotlight is the fact that Niger belongs to Nigerians, as many of them say. Given that people of Niger have been fed up with decades of French rule over their country, what seems to be of high significance for the external powers is that they must stop intervening, either politically or militarily, in Niger, and let the people of Niger decide their own future.
Former Pakistani Prime Minister Imran Khan has spent the first night of his three-year jail term in a high-security prison. The prison at Attock, located just outside Islamabad, is notorious for its harsh conditions. In addition to armed guards standing at watchtowers and perimeter walls, barriers were erected and roads blocked to keep people away. Khan's spokesperson claimed that his lawyers could not reach him. Protests have broken out in parts of the country as a result of Khan's incarceration. The prison is surrounded by his supporters who are demanding his release and alleging that his conviction is politically motivated. A Pakistani trial court on Saturday convicted Khan of charges arising over the sale of state gifts. A passenger train has derailed in Pakistan's southern Sindh province, killing at least 30 people and injuring 80. 8 train cars went off the tracks near the town of Nawabshah, roughly 300 kilometers from the country's largest city of Karachi. At least 1,000 passengers were aboard the train. Wounded passengers have been moved to nearby hospitals while rescue teams are still trying to free people from the twisted wreckage. The railway minister has raised the possibility of a mechanical fault but has not ruled out sabotage. Pakistan has seen a string of deadly train accidents over the past years. In June 2021, two trains collided in Sindh, killing at least 65 people and injuring about 150 others. Between 2013 and 2019, around 150 people died in such incidents. Earlier, we were joined from Karachi by our correspondent Mohammed Touri. He told us how a lack of funding in successive governments has left Pakistan's railway network antiquated and in poor condition.
All the operations, the uptrack operations, are ceased. There are long queues on the railway stations like at Karachi and the other cities' railway stations, where the long queues of the people, of the passengers, have been witnessed because the tracks have been seized for the time because of this incident. And of course, this is not the first incident. We saw burnings before, we saw derailments before. And one of the main causes that the main investment which is required and been long overdue and for the structural changes, for the structural improvement, is lacking here. And not just in this government, but in the previous government as well, we witness multiple incidents of train derailments on this main track. And let me also tell you that this is the British time railway track, which hasn't been upgraded or changed much since. So these are the consequences that we are seeing right now.
And that brings an end to our bulletin for this hour, but don't go away.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
British Petroleum has reported $2.6 billion in profits after hottest month on record. Climate advocates note that oil and gas profits are soaring like the temperature increases they are responsible for. This is while Britons are struggling with the cost of living crisis. According to new reports, England is facing a homelessness crisis, with the number of people living in temporary accommodation in England at a 25-year high. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Truthout noted the London-based oil giant BP reported second-quarter profits of $2.6 billion and announced a 10% dividend raise for shareholders on the heels of what was likely the hottest month on record, a grim milestone that scientists say was made possible by the burning of fossil fuels. While BP's profits for the second quarter of 2023 were far lower than the massive $8.5 billion it logged during the same period last year, a drop caused by falling global oil prices, the company has still raked in $7.6 billion in profits so far this year. The company has set out those profits to investors in the form of share buybacks and dividends. BP said in its earnings announcement that it will repurchase another $1.5 billion worth of its shares over the next 3 months. Jonathan Norona Gant, a senior campaigner at Global Witness, said in a statement recently, in 2021, BP CEO described his company as a cash machine after soaring oil and gas prices boosted profits. Nearly 2 years on, and BP is riding the wave of the energy crisis and handing huge sums of money to its shareholders while the UK's poverty rates spiral. This is what a broken energy system looks like. Oil giants get richer because the rest of us get poorer. Gant added, for BP, the energy crisis has been a giant cash grab. For parents across the country, it has been an impossible choice between feeding their children and paying their bills. BP's earnings report comes as its rival Shell posted $5.1 billion in second quarter profits last week and announced a dividend boost of 15% amid a deadly global heat wave. Nicolo Wojewoda, Europe Regional Director at 350.org, said recently that you would think that those most responsible for the hottest month in recorded human history are being held accountable. Think again. Fossil fuel companies, instead of facing consequences, continue being rewarded with record-breaking annual profits, having cashed in more than $200 billion in 2022 alone. He added, fossil fuel industry profits are soaring alongside the rise in global temperatures they are responsible for. This must end now. We must hold them accountable for the damage they have inflicted, making them pay for it and phasing their dangerous influence out of existence. Recently, a group of U.S. lawmakers led by Senator Bernie Sanders urged the Biden Justice Department to sue fossil fuels companies for leading a decades-long, carefully coordinated campaign of misinformation to obfuscate climate science and convince the public that fossil fuels are not the primary driver of climate change. BP knew about the link between fossil fuels and climate change for years before it began publicly acknowledging the connection and styling itself as a renewable energy leader, a posture it has since abandoned. Like Shell and other oil giants, BP recently walked back some of its stated emission reduction targets and announced plans to produce more fossil fuels than previously expected. Earlier this year, BP said it intends to cut fossil fuel production by 25% below 2019 levels by decade's end, instead of its previous goal of 40%. Dorothy Guerrero, head of policy and advocacy at the UK-based group Global Justice Now, said in response to the recent earnings results that once again BP has raked in highest profits as our planet burns, from people struggling with the cost of living crisis in the UK to communities on the front line of climate disasters in the global south. We're all footing the bill for the reckless profiteering of the fossil fuel industry. Adding, enough is enough. The government must stop turning a blind eye as shareholders line their pockets at our collective expense. It's time to bring in a permanent polluter's tax to hold BP and other fossil fuel companies to account for the damage they continue to wreak. Leaving this industry with the power to profit without consequence is not only morally abhorrent, it's plainly ludicrous in the face of a climate catastrophe that threatens us all. Meanwhile, Press TV reported England is facing a homelessness crisis, with the number of people living in temporary accommodation in England at a 25-year high. Over 104,000 households were in temporary accommodation by the end of March 2023, the highest number since records began in 1998. This is indicative of a 10% jump of homeless people in England compared to last year. Official data shows that 9,520 more households have been placed in temporary accommodation since 2022. Over 131,000 children are also in temporary accommodation, the highest figure on record. Almost 14,000 households were in hotels or bed and breakfast accommodation in the 3 months ending in March. Official figures also show a sharp rise in homelessness in older people in the year ending on the 31st of March and a 33.3% increase in the number of homeless households with a priority need due to old age. Experts say loss of private tenancy is a leading cause of homelessness. Instability in the private rental market, exacerbated in the short term by rising interest rates and mortgage payment increases, has led to steep rent rises and property owners deciding to sell their properties. Campaigners say a lack of housing, exacerbated by decision by the ministers to freeze local housing allowance rates for the past 3 years, also lies at the root of the problem. The number of UK households being issued with no-fault evictions has also risen in the past year, with a 21% increase in those at the risk of homelessness due to a no-fault eviction. The British government has also frozen the local housing allowance at 2020 levels. This is the amount which people claiming household benefits who rent privately are entitled to.
Food for thought.
Hello everyone, and here is some food for thought in the form of a thought-stimulating saying from the martyr of Karbala, Imam Hussein, peace be upon him. The faithful must certainly desire to meet his Lord righteously. I do not deem death other than felicity, and life among the unjust other than suffering and boredom.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Mona and her story. In this moment, having arrived in the city of Gaza once again and being amongst the devastation in the streets, I am very anxious. I have returned to locate someone who is very dear to me. Her name is Mona, and I intend to write her story.
Welcome back, Barbara. Mona lives in Beit Lahia, one of the bordering areas which received heavy shelling and bombardment. You have been before here, but this time the scene is completely different. The destruction is massive.
I met Mona 3 wars ago, which is about 6 years back. I filmed a wedding ceremony back then for a documentary. This couple had just gotten married right when war broke out. The guests were refugees from the Jabalia camp. The joyful scene, however, ended when our camera closed in on Mona's face. Mona knows that she will never get married. No longer does she dream of a fiancé, but she does dream of a prosthesis made in France. An Israeli shell took off one of her legs on the last day of that war. It is impossible for a person in her condition to ever leave Gaza.
I'm trying to work out where she exactly lives because as you see, the landscape has very much changed because of the war.
A deep crater has made a wasteland out of the surrounding area. Everything looks quite different to me, but I find Mona's house still standing, and I believe she is alive. This is Saloh, Mona's father. It is he who found Mona wounded in the local school where she took shelter 6 years ago. I see that she has resigned herself to this crutch, a life on one leg at the border of an abyss dragging herself about. I am struck by the resilience of Gaza. In losing her leg, Mona has also lost the future she dreamt of. Now an amputee, she is not a suitable candidate for marriage. With no prospects for a husband or child, it is not the end of the world, but for a woman in Gaza, it is a great misfortune. Before we know it, we are in front of her uncle's house. He used to be a backhoe driver, a very useful job for digging tunnels for the defenders. I have to leave Mona. She cannot accompany me on my next journey. This school here, which has survived the war, is to be evacuated of refugees so that the students may return. The refugees are grouped in buildings like this. It's an unimaginable situation. A building prepared for 500 students, but now it contains more than 3,000 displaced persons. 60,000 people live in schools under these conditions.
We still have more displaced in our schools now than at the peak of the war in 2009. The frustration of the people is going to increase dramatically over the course of the coming weeks. We have thousands, tens of thousands of families who physically have nowhere to live. And we need to address that. Even independent of a broader political agreement, these people need to have somewhere to live.
Inside the ruins of this house, I found the young members of this family. I have an impregnable view of the life of our young people, and I tell myself that a new generation will arise out of these ruins. Is there any other life possible for them? This is what I wanted to believe for 4 years when I brought Mona to France. Mona was so thankful to be able to walk again. No longer will she suffer immobility now that she has a prosthesis. The prosthesis has ensured a better life for Mona in Gaza. I have come here about 15 times now, and the scene is always the same. The new Al-Wafa Hospital, the only rehabilitation center in Gaza. During the war between Hamas combatants and Israeli forces, the director of the original Al-Wafa hospital protested and as a result had to evacuate all the patients before it could be bombed. The location is now here, a reform house converted into a hospital in a good district.
We used to have a special place for the medical rehab to improve the life of the person and make him able to walk. And that special place was at the hospital that the Israeli destroyed. Right now, we're trying to do the same thing, but in a corridor.
How many people are there in Gaza that are like Mona? 11,000. 11,000 injured people that need rehabilitation.
He got injured from a shot by the Israelis as he was walking in his farm. So he was shot in the back and the spinal cord, so he is paralyzed all the way down. The Israelis' actions by this, they are creating a new segment in the society that is paralyzed. They destroy the place that these people need to get treatment to improve their lives. So the Israelis, systematically, they are trying to destroy the health system in Gaza City so they can leave the people handicapped, they can leave the people unable to improve their lives and put the blockade, more blockade on them, not in the border side, but within themselves.
His eyes flicker the flames of Gaza oil. It's amazing how the strength of life propels one. For example, this man here, who was extracted alive from under the rubble. I have found Monar's father. This piece of land nourishes all of his family. Salah took me to the Mosque Al-Suchi, a tent of Congress standing next to where the actual mosque is located. It is the former Prime Minister of Hamas who is preaching there. I need to see Monar right away so that I may remember the happy times spent with her. There is one final place I have to go, a place where this story began, the Palestinian Center for Human Rights. I have an appointment with the woman who helped me get Monar out of Gaza. Her name is also Monar, Monar Al-Shawa.
This time it's different, that you feel that you are totally alone in this world. You keep asking yourself, when the world will not be silent, when the number of the victims became 500, 5,000 maybe? We are counting 2,000, 2,100, 300, 300 women, 500 children, and no one speaks. Everyone saw this tower like in minutes, and no one speaks. No one, everyone keeps silent. You feel that you are living in an ugly world, very ugly world, unfair. This is unfair. It's really unfair.
This is my last hope to find someone who believes in humanity and still believes when his eyes gaze over Shijaiya, the district which is undoubtedly the most ruined of all in Gaza. I accompanied Mona and her colleagues. The owner of the building is not far away. He is arguing with an officer of the municipality. Mona and her colleagues are seeking a direct narrative without receiving payment. They are advocates of human rights, hoping that one day Israel will appear before the international courts. He had been hiding out here for 4 days before being able to get to hospital. His brother and both of his nephews are dead. They were shot and killed.
And all the Palestinians here say it's a must. We need that. All of them need accountability and need to see all these people who are criminal to have their punishment. Because again, who can guarantee this is, will not have another damage?
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The economies of Iran and Pakistan complement each other, the Iranian foreign minister has said, highlighting the important role that the joint membership of the two neighbors in regional and international organizations can play in the enhancement of their economic relations. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Kayhan International wrote in this regard, in view of the fast-paced positive developments in the region, it is only a matter of time for flow at last of Iranian natural gas to energy-starved Pakistan after an almost decade-long delay. The two countries share a 904 kilometers long border extending from the shores of the Gulf of Oman to the Kuhe Malik Shah Mountain, overlapping the joint border with Afghanistan, and are founding members of the 10-Nation Economic Cooperation Organization, ECCO. Pakistan, which shares many commonalities in history, religion, culture, trade, and language, following its birth in 1947 on the partition of the subcontinent by the British, has shared cordial ties with its western neighbor. It is worth recalling that on November 21, 1979, Islamic students in Islamabad had burnt down the U.S. embassy because of reports of American military designs against the newly founded Islamic Republic of Iran. Tehran and Islamabad have now set their eyes on increasing the volume of bilateral annual trade exchanges to $10 billion, of course not in U.S. currency. Recently in Islamabad, Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian and his Pakistani counterpart Bilawal Bhutto Zardari signed a 5-year strategic plan for commercial cooperation. Abdullahian, in his televised news conference with Bhutto Zardari, was hopeful of Pakistan completing its part of a much-delayed gas pipeline between the two countries, a multi-billion project that has been on hold since 2014 because of U.S. pressures. He said, "We do believe that completion of Iran-Pakistan gas pipeline is definitely going to serve the national interest of our two countries." The project launched in 2013 when Bilawal Bhutto Zardari's father, Asif Ali Zardari, was president of Pakistan, was stalled after his exit from power and the timidity of the succeeding Pakistani administrations to resist American bullying. The completion of the gas pipeline project, in which Iran has invested $2 billion, will definitely be an economic bonanza for Islamabad. In another sign of the fast-expanding mutual relations between the two neighboring countries, a major motorway in Pakistan's commercial capital, Karachi, changed its British name of Clifton Road to Shahrahe Imam Khomeini. As a result, the Imam Khomeini Road is now connected to Shahrahe Iran, which hosts the consulate generals of several countries. Iran believes Pakistan and its Muslim people have the potential to stand up to U.S. pressures in the region and in the Islamic world. And once this takes practical shape, American Zionist-sponsored terrorism against the Islamic Republic, especially in Balochistan, could be weeded out to the benefit of the two Muslim neighbors. Meanwhile, Press TV noted Iran and Pakistan, as two neighboring and influential countries in the West Asia region, share common borders, religious and cultural commonalities, and common customs. And due to their proximity, trade costs between them are very low compared to other countries. Recently, they signed a 5-year strategic plan for commercial cooperation, as Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian met Pakistani leaders in Islamabad during a three-day visit which he said would open a new chapter in their cooperation. Home to 230 million people as the second largest Muslim country after Indonesia, Pakistan is potentially one of the best export destinations for Iranian goods and services. The unique geographical location of Iran gives it a special advantage for exports of goods and services. Hence, the acceleration of foreign investments and exports of goods would lead to mutual benefits for Iran and international economic actors. In this regard, attention should be paid to the consumption of markets of the neighboring countries and Pakistan because of its special room for Iranian goods and services should be a priority. While Iran's main export items to most trading partners are petrochemicals, a diverse volume of goods is exported to Pakistan, which allows the two countries to raise trade to new record highs. They have already doubled the volume of trade to $2.4 billion in recent years, but in view of the existing capabilities, this increase is not satisfactory, Amir Abdullahian said. He told his Pakistani counterpart, Bilawal Bhutto Zardari, "We want to witness the expansion of bilateral cooperation as much as possible in the coming years." Pakistani and Iranian markets are complementary. Pakistan has a developing economy with an increasing need for energy resources, and Iran is one of the richest countries in the world in terms of energy resources. Also, Pakistan can meet some of Iran's needs, especially in agricultural sector. Chambers of commerce, unions, and organizations have a very large role in Pakistan's economy, where the government only regulates and supervises it without trying to interfere in it. Pakistan has been a World Trade Organization WTO member since 1995 and a member of General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, GATT, which covers trade in industrial and agricultural goods with WTO agreements at its heart. The country has free trade agreements with Sri Lanka, China, and Malaysia, and is also a part of the South Asian Association for Regional Cooperation, SAARC. As a result, entry into Pakistan's competitive market for non-WTO members, such as Iran, is not without challenges. Another challenge is the smuggling of goods, especially fuel, due to long and relatively insecure borders where terrorist groups chiefly operate from their lairs in Pakistan. Raw selling, especially of hides, dates, and legumes, also chips away at earnings, while money transfer issues and banking complications related to sanctions on Tehran are a constant headache. Earlier this year, Pakistan authorized barter trade with Iran, Afghanistan, and Russia on specific goods, including petroleum and gas, to bypass Western sanctions on those countries and ease pressure on its declining foreign exchange reserves. The country is scrambling to manage a balance of payments crisis and rein in skyrocketing inflation. The barter trade mechanism lists 26 commodities that Pakistani state and privately owned entities can export to Afghan, Iranian, and Russian markets. In exchange, they can import crude oil, liquid natural gas, liquid propane gas, chemical products, fertilizers, fruits, wheat, industrial machinery, and vegetables from the three countries. One of the recent developments in relations between Iran and Pakistan is the reopening of crossing points to facilitate duty-free trade between border residents of the two neighboring countries. These crossing points greatly reduce the transit time and contribute towards economic integration of the region. Moreover, the two countries' traders are seriously demanding further facilitation of payment systems and also calling for the use of national currencies in their exchanges.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
Hello everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent, a weekly show that aims to address the most significant issues in the South Asian region. In today's program, we'll be discussing the interesting practices followed in the subcontinent during the holy month of Muharram.
In this special episode of The Subcontinent, we will discuss the rich culture of the subcontinent showcased through mourning rituals during Muharram. And we shall also take a look at interfaith unity observed in the subcontinent during the Islamic month of mourning.
Muharram holds immense spiritual significance for the Muslims of the Indian subcontinent. It marks the martyrdom of Imam Hussein, the beloved grandson of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon them, at Karbala. As the crescent moon ushers in this sacred month, the preparation for the age-old Muharram rituals begins throughout South Asia. From the solemn mourning ceremonies to the distribution of food, these traditions, steeped deep in history, present the rich cultural heritage of the subcontinent.
Muharram rituals across the subcontinent are diverse, reflecting a rich tapestry of devotion. Majalis, or religious gatherings as an important part of these rituals, are regularly held in mosques and imambaras where scholars recount the events of Karbala. The portraiture of the desert sieged by Yazid's army, the water supply cut off in the hottest weather, gives a peep into the brutal treatment that was given to the family of the Prophet, peace be upon him. These gatherings also serve as a platform for disseminating profound lessons to stand for truth and justice. An important tradition that can be seen across the subcontinent is the Taziyah procession. Beautifully crafted replicas of Imam Hussein's tomb, known as Taziyahs, are carried through the streets in a symbolic funeral procession. Taziyahs exist in the Indian subcontinent as an expression of devotion and love, also reflecting the rich Indian art. The Muharram processions in South Asia are grand spectacles accompanied by recitation of the pathetic story of the martyrdom of Imam Hussein. These poetic recitations, also known as Noha or Marsiya, form an important part of the mourning rituals. The rhyme and rhythm, intensified by the figurative language in local colors, and the disciplined beat of the mourners recreate the scenes of Karbala and the massacre of the holy family of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, immortalizing their unmatched martyrdom.
Talking about the interfaith unity in India during the month of Muharram, there is an unusual community of mourners who carry their own procession of Taziyah and beat their chests like Shia Muslims. The interesting fact is that they are Hindus known as Husseini Brahmins. Also called as Mohyals, this community of Hindus from North India believes that its ancestors fought on Imam Hussein's side at Karbala and many of them died in the battle. Continuing the legacy, this community cherishes its mythic lineage to Imam Hussein and reveres the grandson of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon them.
For centuries, the subcontinent has been a melting pot of heterogeneous traditions and beliefs. The pluralistic worldview can also be observed during the Islamic holy month of Muharram. From participating in the religious gatherings to the distribution of food, people from varied religious backgrounds participate in various rituals surrounding Muharram.